We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, good morning. We'll get started. I think we have a lot to cover, right? Hayom Katsar V'Hamlacham Meruva.
Apoalim
Asilim is always right. Okay, I didn't want to say that, right? Anyways, our big man is already, this is, I believe, the sixth time he's speaking in Toronto, right? Twice on Friday and four times yesterday. I'm sorry, our seventh time he's speaking in Toronto. So those haven't heard him yet. He's well worth hearing. The Rosh Yeshiva in Malay Gilboa. He was the first posek, he told me yesterday, the first posek of the Kibbutz Hatzati in Sde Eliyahu, and he's a graduate of Wayne State University, a student in Detroit, Harav Bas, learned by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in Chicago, learned by Harav Gusman in Eretz Yisrael, and now he teaches many in Malay Gilboa. So without further ado, Harav Bigman.
I would have to tell you a little bit about my methodology, since this is even the people who have heard me this over the Shabbat, this is the first session in which we're doing what I do on an everyday basis. And if we mentioned Rav Gusman, I'll tell you a little about this year. It's very deeply influenced by Rav Gusman in a very strange way. So I will explain a little bit about how I work and how I got where I am, and I'll tell, and then you'll see how it bears on this particular issue of Prusbo. So when I learned in Skokie, our Rebbe used to say to us, Rashi is a Rishon, and therefore you should take what he has to say with a grain of salt, because there might be a different way of looking at the sugya. But then when I learned with Rabbi in Detroit, he used to say, Rashi didn't have Rashi, which is not true historically, because Rashi had mentors from Areshum, Shvayer, Worms, and Magenza. And so he had background and he had traditions, and he relates to what his mentors told him. There's a place in Beitzah that he talks about the fact that he was dissatisfied with his explanation of the sugya, and he went back. I don't know if he went back with the whole purpose of his trip. And he asked his Rabbeinu Yitzchak, I think, and he didn't like what they had to say either about sugya, as a matter of fact. But he did have traditions and he did have mentors. But Rabbach's point was that we should learn the Gemara first on our own, and then look at Rashi as a commentary on the Gemara, and not what we call in Israel etzba etzba. One figure in the Gemara and one figure, hopefully, in Rashi, not in Steinsaltz or Aristotle or something. And so Rabbach was adamantly against that, and he said the main thing is to pay attention to the Gemara. Then, many years later, I was fortunate enough to learn with Rav Gusman, and then I started realizing that there is other material as well. Pshat Mishnah, Tosefta, Midrashei Halakha, wealth of material, Yerushalmi. Rav Gusman all had at his fingertips. Rav Gusman used to say that when he would learn a Mishnah at the beginning of the Masechet, his father would put his hand, I don't know if you heard this, he put his hand on Rashi and on the Gemara, and he would say, Yisrael, how do you understand the Gemara? The Mishnah. And then he would take his hand off and he said, now compare what you explained to what Rashi explained. So all of this culminated when I came back to Malay Gilboa after my year with Rav Gusman, and I had to teach my friends on the kibbutz Moed Katan. We had a shiur once a week, Moed Katan. Biyun. Seriously, we learned Moed Katan. And then I all of a sudden it dawned on me that not only did Rashi not have Rashi, the Gemara did not have the Gemara either. So I started taking apart the Gemara by strata, which is now known in Israel as Rivadim. But when I started, it was not called Rivadim. It was, some people just said it, called it Shitat Bigman, even. Because it didn't have a name, and the academic world wasn't doing this yet so much. And so I used to take apart the Sugiya, but I would also look at all the primary material. So most of it had a bearing on the Gemara itself. Most of it had a bearing on the Gemara itself. And once, years ago, when I was teaching in Ein Sorim, we had a young teacher who came from the Gush. He was a Talmid of Aaron Lichtenstein. So he said to Aaron Lichtenstein, he was amazed at the fact that I pay attention to the Pshat of the Mishnah. So he came to Aaron Lichtenstein and he said, Rabbi Bigman learns Pshat Mishnah. And Rabbi Lichtenstein said, that's not proper to do that. And then he went back to him a few weeks later, and he said, Rabbi Bigman learns Pshat of the Mishnah to understand the Gemara better. And then Rabbi Lichtenstein said, that is certainly proper. And the truth is, what I do is improper and proper, because I'm concerned with the voice of the Mishnah itself. Proper and proper in Rabbi Lichtenstein's eyes. Because I learned the Mishnah for its own value, and also to understand later developments better. Yes?
Wouldn't the most important point in learning Gemara to learn it by Sugya, since the Gemara isn't written in Sugya? You know what I mean?
If I understand you correctly, the final culmination of this is to see the final Sugya in its complete fashion.
What I mean is, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, right, there's a topic, and they bring Gemara is in from 10 different places. But when you learn a Gemara by doctrine, you don't do that. Wouldn't that be the most important way to learn a piece of Gemara?
By topic?
Yes.
I have a question that you made.
Okay, I know we're going to spend the whole morning this methodology. I think that all Sugiyot should be learned that have to do with a certain topic. But I think the starting point should be the particular sukkiah out here. When this also I learned from Gusma, even though this is my tradition before, from the time that I was in Skokie. Rav Gusman's father-in-law, Rav Bassan, learned with Rav Chaim in Brisk. And Rav Chaim in Brisk had many, many people who were great Talmudic scholars in his shiur. And they would ask him, when he was studying a specific sukkiah, they would ask him questions from other sukkiah. And then Rav Chaim would say, we will compare to other sugiyot later on. We are now learning this sugiyah. And I want to get all of the meaning of this sugiyah first.
That's not what I mean. I mean, for example, if you're learning Muktzah and you learn Beah, so you learn the first block and a half, and it's Muktzah. But most of Muktzah is in Shabbos and in 10 different places in Shabbos. Shouldn't you learn all those Gemoras on Muktzah before you go somewhere else?
No, you shouldn't.
Why?
Because what you should do is learn all of the early material, the Tanakh material, about Muktzah before you even start. That's
why?
The overview which is important. If you start learning all the Gemarot, you won't understand the development of Muktzah, and you won't understand the unbelievable creative work that the Amoraim and the Saboraim did in the development of the concept of Muktzah.
So once you reach the Gemara, okay.
So once you read some words, it's a different story. But even then, you should do it point by point, because otherwise you'll miss the message of the specific sugiya. At the end, you can make an overview and connect all the material together. That's my opinion. But we're not going to argue about it now, because we're going to have time to learn if we argue about methodology. But there was one other question about methodology.
How do you relate to the Gisha of the Weiss Halivni, who has Zilbadim?
Yeah, I relate to it. I understand it completely, although my methodology is slightly different. We've become friendly over the years, but Weiss HaLibni very often pins it on a technical issue. And I tend to think that the issues are more conceptual and even sometimes value-oriented. And then I learned a lot from my Rebbe, including Rav Gusman, who used to say, when you see the Gemara bringing three different midrashim to explain a certain concept, each midrash implies a different way of looking at the halakha. The particular one I remember was the concept of halal that we hit in Yevamot. And there are two different midrashim of why the halal's avodah is considered kasher b'diavad. And then he said each one is a different concept of halal. Okay, so that I'm more conceptual. In that sense, I'm yeshivish. Because I think, even though I have very good rapport with Professor Aligny and we understand each other, but he tends to hinge things on technical issues, and sometimes I don't think that. Him and also Shama Friedman, who's also a dear friend of mine, but also he tends to hinge on technical things, and sometimes I think there's something deeper going on. Okay, so now we will get into the material at hand, and we'll have some self-study, and then I'll tell you what I think about what happened to Prusbo, how the concept of Prusbo developed, and where it stems from. And this is not, this is all very original, because some of the work was done by other people like Professor Henschke, but nobody sort of skirted around the major issue. So that's what we're going to try to hit, the major issue of how Prusbo works. And if we don't have time to finish this off, it's been published in Akdamot, I think 2 issues ago. So you can read the articles if you don't finish off. So what I'd like to do now is just disperse for a few minutes and have you read at least the Mikorot, which are 1, 2, and 3. At least those three. 3 is rather long. Okay? But there is a mistake in the translation of Cencino in one particular line. So if you bear with me for a minute, I want to correct that mistake, because if anybody reads the English, they'll be completely misled. And this mistake is not the one of my students who helped with the translation, but rather of the Cencino translation, and it's quite an obvious mistake, and I don't know how it was made. Because if you look at line, if you look at Law 5, what he calls Law 5, Mishnah Hey, if you look at the Hebrew in Mishnah Hey, it's on page 2, and the English is on page 3. The Hebrew says, Kuzbol Hamukdam Kasher, Vamuchar Pasul, Shidrei Chov Hamukdamim Psulim, Vamucharim Ksherim. So that has to do with the dating of the document. Okay? A Kuzbo, which is dated earlier than it should be, is considered alright. But if it's dated later than the date that it actually took place, it's not considered. It's considered pasul. With shidrei chov, how do they translate shidrei chov? Legal document is not a good example, not a good translation. Shidrei chov, IOUs, yeah, IOUs, which are dated too early, are pasul, and the ones that are late are okay. Okay, I'll explain it about Shitrei Chov, and I won't explain Puzbo now because that has to do with the Shiur. But it's the reverse of one another, and in the Cencino translation, they have them the same. And in the Mishnah, they are reversed. So I don't know how that happened, but the reason that Shitrei Chov, why it's so important for them not to be dated earlier than they should be, is because of leanings on land. In other words, there is Shi'abud. And if you date it too early, the people who come to collect from somebody who's in debt, they have their rights are dependent on when they lent you the money. So if you on the document that testifies about the loan, you have an early date, it gives you rights as versus the other debtors. So are you following me? It gives you rights before, so it's unfair. If the first person who gave the loan should have the first right to collect from the property. The person who gave the second loan has the second right, and so on. So if you date the IOU too early, it gives you rights that don't belong to you. So that's why this translation is wrong. But in Prusbo, it's just the opposite. In Prusbo, if you date it too early, you're okay. If you date it too late, you're not okay. Okay, so that we'll discuss after you learn the Mishnah. So let's at least learn these three sources. If you find the third one rather long, you can sort of skim over it to get an overview. So we have 1, 2, and 3. At least that will do a self-study. And then, Jay, what time, how much time do we have, Reverend Jay? How much time do we have?
Altogether?
Until about 11:30. Okay, so we'll take a break now for about a half hour at least, and we'll see how we can. See, it should be enough to get through the first three sources, and then we'll see from there. And I can help you. Like, we'll do it like I do in the Beit Midrash. Okay, if anybody has any problems, I'll be here to help out with the source material, just like we do in the yeshiva.
I think
we're gonna have to push forward with this a little bit. That's our review, and I think everybody's having fun learning, which is great. So that's the main thing. But I think that because my theory about this is so outlandish that I have to get started, because I think we may have a long discussion about this. So I think that everybody's sort of floundering, not because they can't understand the material, but I think once you hear my thesis, you'll see how well the material is read. So we will start from the very beginning, which is, and we have this concept of Shmitat Kesafim that appears in the Torah that implies that when the Shemitah year comes, then all loans are dissolved. And as a result of that, in the classical approach to Prusbo is that Hillel instituted the Prusbo to solve the problem. This classical approach is influenced by mainly two sources. Okay? One source appears on this sheet. The other source is a very long and complicated piece, sugiya, in Masechet Gittin, in Daf Lamed Vav. I didn't bring that material because it doesn't bear on my thesis. But I did want to do justice to the classical approach, so I brought the Sifre. I quote the Sifre on the page. And the Sifri is not necessarily the classical approach because of one nuance that it has. However, it does put the Prusbo clearly in the Shemitah context, which is what was important to me. So let's read the Sifre together. The Sifre is Midrash Halakha. Midrash Halakha is a form of Beraita, what we would call a Beraita. And it is a source that includes early Tanaic material and later Tanaic material into the first generation of Amoraim. And how it was compiled is, I would say, a whole can of worms, exactly how it was compiled. But it certainly includes both early materials and later materials, including, and it's certainly the final edition is later than the Mishnah. How do we know the final edition is later than the Mishnah? I don't want to say our whole compiled Mishnah, but at least it includes parts of our Mishnah, because very often it says, Mikan Amru. It makes a certain homily from the Tzukim, and it says, on the basis of this homily, the Mishnah says, Mikan Amru, and it quotes Mishnah. So we know that this drasha is meant to be a basis for the Mishnah that is already existent at the time this material was edited. Okay? And that is the case in this particular Sifre. So let's read it together. Et anochri tigos mitzvah haseh, but that's an argument among the Rishonim, whether one should lend with interest to the non-Jew. V'asher yelecha et achicha b'lo shel achicha b'yadecha. When you have an outstanding loan of your brothers, but not when your brother's property is in your hand, so to speak. Therefore, we know that if you have given a loan and you have collateral, is that the right word? So then, the Shemitah doesn't apply, because it's not only a loan, in a certain sense, you already have the payment. You have an option of the payment in your hands. And the Chidat Tishmet Yadecha, the law homoser shterotav lebeitin, and you should forego the loans of your brother, but not of somebody who has passed on his documents to beitin. These two concepts, the concept of mashkon and the concept of passing on the documents to Beit Din are the classical way the Rishonim understand how crucible works. Either it works because it is considered in a certain way already having collateral, or it works because it is considered as if you have given your documents to Beit Din, in which case Beit Din is the collector and not you. Okay? Even though it's done in a fictitious way, which is one of the problems that we're going to deal with as we go on. Okay. So then it says, Mikan amru hitkin hilel kuzbo v'teki kun olam. She'ra'a ta'am she'nu milal vod zed zeva amru ma she'ketub b'Torah amad v'hitkin kuzbo v'zeh gufo shofo. So this is a quote of the Mishnah. Okay. So this implies that Hillel's kuzbo was made to solve the problem of Shemitah. Right? And this is the classical approach. What's the mechanism is dependent on different sources and on the explanations of the Rishonim, under the assumption that the Puzbo was enacted to solve the problem of Shemitah. Okay? So this is the thesis that appears in the Bavli in Daf Kitin Lamed Vav, which I want to try to overturn. Because I don't think that is the case at all. Okay? But what got me...
You don't want to overturn what it says anymore. You want to overturn our understanding of it.
No, I want to overturn it more. I will explain to you. I want to explain that this is the approach of the Bavli, and possibly of the Sifrei, but it's not the only approach. That's more exact way of saying it. In other words, even though the Bavli assumes in Daf Lamed Vav in Gittin, the Bavli in Gittin Lamed Vav, not necessarily the Bavli in other places, but in that particular sugya, the Bavli understands Puzbo as being enacted in the context of Shemitah, I would like to suggest that the original Puzbo was not enacted in the context of Shemitah. And the strangest thing is that the first source that draw my attention to this problem is the source that everybody would assume puts Puzbo exactly in the context of Shemitah. Okay? Which is the Mishnah that appears in front of you. Okay? So we're going to just have to do what we talked about in the title structural analysis. It has to do with the structure of the Mishnah. So here we go. We have a list. I don't even go into the details of the list. I just want you to notice that there's a list. Shvi'it mishametet et ha'meve b'shtar v'shelo b'shtar. Hakafat, we have shvi'it, what's it, echom mishametet, my name?
Cancels.
The alone which has a document and one that doesn't. And then we have a list of things that Shemitah does not cancel. Hakafat ha'chanut eina mishametet. If you have credit at a store, is that the right word? Then it doesn't speak out. But once it's become an official loan, then it does. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Arishon Mishamet. It depends on how it was done, and as you go along, the Shvita takes one at a time. Schar Tzachir Eino Mishamet. If you owe your worker money for payment of his wages, Shemitah is not canceled. But once it's become an official loan, your worker has said, let's make this into a loan, your debt to me, then Shemitah does apply. Rabbi Yos Merkol Mochashe Posekit Bishviit Mishamete, Sheinat Posekit Bishviit Eina Mishamete. If there's a certain work which is done and it has a certain sum which is in the person who has ordered the work owes the Baal Melacha.
The
Baal Melacha.
Yeah,
artisan, whatever, then Shemitah does apply, but otherwise it doesn't. Hashochet Tapara, this has to do with Yom Tov. This has a different problem. This has to do with when Shemitah occurs. What they used to do is they would have somebody would buy a cow for everybody and they would do Shemitah and Yom Tov and divide it. And everybody would owe him money. So it depends on the date of Rosh Hashanah. Whether Shemitah applies, that's a separate question. This is very important. All of these instances in which somebody owes money because of something horrible he's done, and there is a knas, then it's considered maaseh beitin. It's not, and shmitah doesn't cancel it. Hamaveh ala mashkon moseh shtaratav de beitin ein mishamtin. These are the things mentioned by the Sifrei. If it's a mashkon or if he's passed on his documents to beitin, then it's not mishamet. End of the list. Pruzbo eino mishamet. Okay, so let's see if you have ears. I'm going to check if you have ears. That's a Hebrew expression. Yisrael was 9 to hear. We have this list of things that Shemitah doesn't apply to. That Shemitah doesn't cancel. Okay, it's a list of things. The last thing on the list is Pruzbol. So let me ask you a simple question. If Pruzbol was enacted to solve the problem of Shemitah, what is it doing in a general list of things that Shemitah doesn't apply to? Should I ask it again? We have this list of things that Shemitah doesn't cancel. Loans that Shemitah doesn't cancel, they're not exactly loans. And therefore, Shemitah doesn't apply to them. At the end of the list, we have Pruzbol. How could that be? If the whole point of Pruzbol was to cancel the cancellation, it should be in the list. It should be a whole topic of its own. Okay? So why do people think it is? So now we have 3 minutes of helping the Bavli. Okay? So the first thing that helps the Bavli is the Sifrei that we already studied. But there is something in the Mishnah which would lead you to that conclusion. Okay? That is the part that I have put indented. Okay? And the reason I put it indented is to help my own thesis. But if I didn't indent it, then we would see the following thing. Ze echad mehadvarim shitkin Hillel Zakein shera'a shenidu'u ha'am milhalvot ze et ze. Listen to the words. I'm going to do my best to explain it the way the Bavli understands it. It's going to be very difficult for me because I'm very convinced of my thesis. But I'm going to try to explain the way the Bavli understands it. Okay? So, ze echad mehadvarim shitkin Hillel Zakein Shera'a shenidu'u ha'am milhalvot ze et ze. When did people not give loans to one another? So according to the Bible, we have to add in parentheses before Shemitah, okay? And vo'ovrim al mashi katuv b'Torah, sukim that are mentioned in the context of Shemitah. 2 points for the Bavli. Kishamer lecha. And then it says Karvah Shnat Hasheva Shnat Hashmitah. The pasuk is in the context of Shemitah, and therefore Hikin Hillel Pruzbol. Okay, so that's the and all the things that it says in the Mishnah through all the indented part is a long. How do we say, Jen, we should call COVID? COVID. How do we say COVID?
Compendium.
Compendium. The whole compendium, which is indented here, has to do with Pruzbol. It is put into the context of Perek Yud Masechet Shvi'it. So it appears to have to do with Shvi'it. The Pasuk has to do with Shvi'it. Okay? So what I would like to posit is that the original Pruzbol does not have to do only with Shvi'it, but it does, this compendium appears in Shvi'it because it has great significance to Shvi'it. But the Pruzbol was not enacted for Shvi'it at all. And the only reason that Hillel mentioned the Pasuk that has to do with Shvi'it was because there is an isur in the Torah for people not to give loans to one another when they are in need. And that pasuk appears in the context of Shvi. But there is only one pasuk in the Torah that talks about people who are not giving loans to one another.
It only appears in the context of Shvi.
Yes.
When, now when we were learning this, there's a little bit of a problem. In the Chumash, it talks on staka, right? You have to give, you have to open up your hand, don't touch your fist, etc. And then it says, be careful, like, it's sort of a non, it doesn't connect. Be careful not to lend money. If you're giving staka, it's not a loan. In other words, the way the Torah...
Okay, I'm not going to get into that, but if you really want to... The Chafetz Chaim wrote a whole book about that, which he calls Avat Chesed, which I'm screwing the issue on purpose, but we'll make parentheses now for a minute, and we will talk about it a little bit. The Torah, since the Torah does not allow rebate, all loans are viewed as something that is staka-oriented. Okay?
Mandatory?
Sort of mandatory, right. Yes. Almost like, like we saw. And then, but, I didn't mean to talk about this, but it's important background. In the time of Chazal, even though there is no rebate, loans are not given only out of for staka reasons. Loans are given both for staka reasons, but also because the lender hopes to get a bargain. Okay, this is many sugyot in the Shas. How does he expect to get a bargain? His hope is that the lender will not be able to pay back the loan, and when he makes the leaning on his property, it's always better, slightly better than what he would get on the market. Does everybody follow me? So let's say an acre of land costs, how much does an acre of land cost?
Depends where.
Depends where. Okay. You mean something to go on?
$1 million.
$1 million, okay? So he gives, so let's say an acre of land costs $1 million, right? He gives somebody a loan for $900,000, and he has a lien on an acre of land. If the person cannot pay back the loan, he's got an acre at a bargain. Okay, that's why Chazal have a special takana, which is that you can only make the loan on benonit and not on idit. A certain kind of quality of land, because they were afraid that people would be too speculative about this. They didn't want a lot of speculation, and they thought that people would take advantage of this too much, so they made a takana that the leaning can only be on benonit, on land which is mediocre, and not what they call idit, which has to do with agriculture, not with with real estate. Then the thought was agriculture, not real estate. Okay? So that is the context. So there is a context here which is very strange, because in the Torah it certainly is a staccat kind of concept alone, even though it wasn't done that way during the time of Torah, as we know from Tanakh, right? We know that some people were indentured because of, right? But in the time of Chazal, it's not so staccat oriented. People hope to get at least their money back and possibly the property. Okay. So now, what was the problem? That if I want to posit that Hillel was not dealing with the Shemitah problem, what was he dealing with? I'm going to try to prove this as we go on, but I first want to explain the concept. I saw that everything kind of lost, and everything reads completely differently if you accept this point of view. So we have found in papyrus documents in Egypt the concept of crucible. And there it says that the courts give the person the loaner, is that a better word for it?
The lender,
my English is very rusty. We give the lender the right to collect from the
borrower
by force and auction off the stuff he takes. Okay? That it's like a court order, but it doesn't say that the police will come and take away your property. It gives the lender himself the right to coercively take the property of the lender. Okay, that's what the puzzle does. Okay? So it's a court order. What?
Assuming that without this puzzle, there's no way of recovering the loan?
That's exactly the point. I would say, I wouldn't say no way, I would say very difficult. Because you probably could have the courts take care of it. But then having the courts take care of it means long litigation and depending on the public authorities. This is a way of circumventing it. How do you circumvent it? Originally, with the agreement of the borrower himself. Okay? Is everybody following me? In other words, in order to facilitate the loan, because you know that in the future it would be very difficult to get your money back, you go to the courts, and with the agreement of the borrower, you get this court order that allows you to forcibly take it from him. Okay, so then you come with the court order later on, and you take your property by force. Yes?
Question. If you recover more than the value of the loan, you have to give it back to him. So it's no advantage to say that the lender would have an advantage in lending him $900,000. If you recover $1 million, you have to give him back $100,000.
No, that's not the way it works, but that's not important right now. What's important is that at least you get the same amount of money. I was giving you background, but at least you get your money back. People were afraid of lending, and the principle in the Hellenistic world, not only in our world, the principle was instituted to make sure that the lender gets his money back. But according to our Mishnah, that's not the reason Hillel adopted the principle. Right, it says he keep principle. What does it mean he keep principle? Did he make it up and everybody copied us? Or did he adopt this Hellenistic procedure into what we call Hamishpat HaIvri, into our system? It would seem to me that way. But whichever way it was, what was he concerned with according to the Mishnah? Was he concerned with the lenders or the borrowers?
The lender,
the borrower.
So that's the thing. So you see, just like as any economist knows, one is dependent upon the other. But it says in our text is that Hillel was not concerned with the lenders. He was concerned with the borrowers, but he understood that the lenders were wary of what would happen to their loan. The borrowers would not get their loans. So then he quotes the pasuk that says that you should lend money. And if you don't lend money, then people are going to be in dire straits. So he suggests this procedure that will give the lender confidence enough so that the borrower can get his loan. This procedure that exists in the Hellenistic world. It does affect Shemitah very deeply. Okay? So now if I ask you, yes, question.
What was his original intention? You said it wasn't.
Shemitah, one of my students said, I'll say it in Hebrew. I gave this shiur, one of my students, he's now a teacher at a yeshiva, and I gave this to the public shiur, and then he said, he's very, as we would say in Hebrew, he's a jinji. He is actually a jinji. He's very harif. He said, Bigman, everybody likes your vort. That's what we call it, your vort. However, I have a question. Do you mean to say that Shemitah is a korban of the principle and it wasn't enacted for the Shemitah? And he said, that's exactly what I want to say. Yes. He was trying to get at me, and I said, that's exactly the case. It is very, very much, it applies very much to Shemitah. But it wasn't enacted for Shemitah, it just affects Shemitah very deeply. Now I would like to ask you what the mechanism, and then I'm going to try to prove the thesis. What is the mechanism? If this is the case, it is considered a court order, what in the Mishnah is similar to that, kind of instance in which we say Shemitah does not apply? We've read a bunch of instances in the Mishnah that Shemitah does not apply. So just look at Mishnah Bet, the last two lines.
Can I just ask one question?
Yes.
So you're suggesting that the concept of the principle did not exist on anything
before Hillel instituted it?
Yes.
So in other words, you're saying there was no... In other words, people weren't concerned about getting their... weren't concerned about getting their land back, or I mean their money back? And it was that, that Hillel instituted it for that purpose? Is that what you're saying?
We have to talk about halakhic practices in general, right? So as people, for certain historical and economic, because of certain historical and economic circumstances, the lenders became wary of getting their loans back. Every loan has a shtar. There is a document. And with that document, you should be able, it includes shibud karkaot, a leaning on land. So you should be able to do that. I don't know exactly what the economic and social circumstances were that created a situation in which the lenders were wary of getting their money back. I don't know what, but I know that it existed because it exists throughout the Hellenistic world, not only in Eretz Yisrael, because we have it in the Hellenistic Egypt, right? So we know that this, something happened, but then I don't know exactly what the historical circumstances were. I do know that the historical circumstances change at least two more times, and the principle develops out of the original way. Because, yeah, okay, so more questions, yes.
It would seem to me, if you use the word that the Shemitah was a korban of the principle, in a very strange way. Essentially, it seems to me, they were searching for a way to circumvent the rule, and to find a way, a loophole, through which, and the evidence of that is, that Hillel, it says clearly, he instituted a principle or adapted a rule from somewhere else to make sure it works within this context.
No, it's not the context, though.
No,
it's not the context. Excuse me. I will soon show to you that it is not the context. It's only the Bavli that accepts the context.
I understand it's not the context with which the principle originated.
No.
However, it was a convenient rule to adopt for the purpose of Shemitah.
It's not the context, even in our sources, it's not the context. Well, I haven't given you the proofs yet. It's not the context. To say that the Shemitah is a korban is only that Jinji, my Talmid, his name is Moshe Kana. I would say it's a korban, but I just was joking with him, because I think that it is a very, very positive.
Byproduct.
It's a positive byproduct, but it was not instituted for that purpose. The reason it's a byproduct was, and we're getting to that in a minute, okay? I'm going to try to prove the thesis. By the way, let me tell you, I get this shiur many times. So one person came up to me and he said, for years and years it bothered me that the puzzle was this fiction that circumvents Shemitah. What we are going to show is that it's not a fiction at all. And it wasn't meant to circumvent, it wasn't instituted to circumvent Shemitah. Okay, that's what I want to show you. But how I will, it takes, we have some more sources to study here. So let's, wait, is there a question here?
I'm just wondering if you see principle as a subcategory of homoseric shtavabay.
Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about right now, exactly in the place, because we're going to talk about three approaches now that have to do with two lines of the Mishnah that appear before principle. So let's read those two lines, okay? It's the last two lines in Mishnah Bet. Ha'ones v'amefateh v'amotzi shem ra. The kol maase beitin ein mishamtim. Hamalveh al ha-mishkon v'amoseh shtarotav le-beitin einan mishamtim. Okay? So we have these two lines, and then we have puzbo eino mishamet. So all the Rishonim either take one half of the last line or the other half. Either it's hamalveh al ha-mishkon, that you, listen how similar this is to our idea, but it's not exactly the same. They say that the puzbol gives you the right through baiting, you have a leaning on your fellow's property, so it is like a mashkon. Okay? That's the one opinion of the Rishonim. The other opinion of the Rishonim, that it is mosar shtarotav le-baitin, and since then baiting becomes the lender, so to speak, and that solves the problem. Okay? I would like to suggest that even though all these ideas are very similar, that the more proper connection for Shemitah is the previous line, Maaseh Beitin. Okay? The reason, the mechanism that works, this is very similar to the Rishonim, but slightly different. The mechanism here is that once you have a court order that gives you the right to collect your fellow's property, what is the source of your collection? Is it the original loan or is it the court order? Is everybody following me? In other words, there was a loan, but now you have a court order. So the original loan is not relevant anymore. It's a court order, just like any other court order. And that's what circumvents the Shvi'it, Maaseh Beitim. But I don't say this because of just when. I say this because of the next page. Let's continue quickly. Okay, we have to go look at number 7. Number 7 is like the strongest, but we have a bunch of them. Rabbiud Omer Puzbol HaMikushar is a special kind of number 7. 7. Resource 7. It's on page 5.
Okay.
So look at source 7. It says, Rabbiud Omer Puzbol HaMikushar HaDainim Chodmim Bifnim Vaidim Bachutz. There was a process, this has very much to do with what we're talking about, of Kiyuma Shtar, and they have a very special kind of document. You can see it. The document was documented in Yigal Yadin's book about Bar Kokhba. He had the picture of the Geta Mukushar. So this Shtar is a very special kind of kind that they did to verify it, and they had certain signatures in the inside and the outside to make sure that it was a true document, sort of kind of notarization. So that it could not be falsified. Okay? So then, but we don't have to know all that. All we have to see is the next line. The Puzbol HaMikushar, Rabbi Yehuda says, needs this kind of notarization, this verification. Amru lo, Chachamim said to him, Ein Maaseh Beitim Sichim Kiyum. So how do they view Puzbol? But that's not the only place that we see Puzbol in the context of Maaseh Beitin or Gzar Beitin. Look at number 9. Gizrei Beitin v'puzbulin harei ze yachzir lefish katuv al shmo. This has to do with somebody finds a document. But we don't really need the context. Somebody finds a document, who does he return it to? So they say you can return it to the loaner, right, the lender, or whoever the person deserves to get the money from the because of the writ of court, right? But what is the context that is put together? Yisrei Beitin Puzbulin. Okay, look at number 10. This one has a lot, very important one. I'm just saying that Puzbulim are in the family of Yisrei Dinim. Okay. Well, okay, so it's not exactly the same as the Gzar Beitim, but it's very similar. And that's why it appears, look, it depends on how you read the source material. We have two in which they appear together, and one that specifically says that the reason it doesn't need Kiyum is because it's considered Maaseh Beitim. So that shows you that it's a subcategory in Maaseh, it's considered Maaseh Beitim and not Gzar Beitim, if you want to be exact. Do you want me to explain the difference between Gzar Beitin and Maaseh Beitin? It's very simple. Gzar Beitin is when you have a court issue like Oneg, Mefater, somebody, there's this litigation, right? And at the end of the litigation, Beitin says, you have to pay somebody money, right? But Maaseh Beitin is not a result of litigation. It's a court order, but not a result of litigation. That's why there's no Gzar. Right, so Puzbol would be a Maaseh Beitin, but it's in the family of Gzar Beitin. It's not Gzar Beitin itself. It's a close relative. Before it could be Gzar Beitin, we need litigation. There's no litigation here. Okay? So that's why it's similar to Gzar Beitin, but it's not. To be exact, it's Maaseh Beitin. I'm happy about that question. Actually, in my article, I didn't discuss it at all. Just sort of, because it was long enough as it was. But there is a difference. You're right. Gzar Beitin and Puzbol are not the same, but they're close relatives. Because Gzar Beitin means that there's some kind of litigation. Okay. It means they don't even have to be notarized. Okay. Since the document is a court document, it doesn't need notarization.
Okay?
Right.
Is everybody okay with that? Okay, so now look at number 10. This is very important because it has significance for another issue. Gizrei dinim upuzbolim shelomidat shnehem. Gizrei dinim, number 10 on page 5. Okay. Oh, 6 in the English. 5 in the Hebrew, 6 in the English. So you look at number 10. Gizrei dinim upuzbolim shelomidat shnehem. Gizrei beitin and upuzbolim can be done without the litigants. Okay? Rabbi Omer. Omer ani shen kodzi puzbul ela midat haloveh. I say haloveh, there's an argument between the two kitveyad, but loveh makes more sense here. In other words, you don't give the right to the malveh to have this leaning originally on the lo, to have this court order without the loveh agreeing to it. Okay? But that is not what appears in our Mishnah. We have several sources which it would imply that this is done with the understanding of both sides, okay? But in our Mishnah, it is not done with the understanding of both sides. So let's go back to our Mishnah. Okay. Well, you haven't finished all the proofs yet. Okay, but in order to get to the next proof, we have to get to this point. So look at Mishnah Dalet, page 2 in the Hebrew and page 3 in the English, and it's Mishnah Dalet or Law 4. Okay? Zegufo shalapuzbol. This is how it's said. Moser ani lachem, ish ploni v'ploni adayim shemukom ploni, shekol chov shiyesh li, shegvenu kol zman she'erze. V'adayim chutmin lamata, OAD. So, what does the lender say in front of the Beit Din? All loans that are pending, Chov Sheyesh Li, I now would like to have the right to collect at any time I will. Okay? So if you view the puzbol as Moser Shtarotav, passing on your loans to Beitin, or you view it as Mashkon, these words don't make so much sense. But if you view it as a Maaseh Beitin, a court order, they make absolute sense. Is everybody following me? Because they become a fiction if you say it's Moser Shtarotav the Beitin, what has he passed on? And all Rishonim are concerned with is that the Nusach doesn't have anything to do with passing on your documents. You would think that he would take the documents and put them up. So they say, some of the Rishonim say that Moser Shtarotav the Beit Din would work Midoraita. And the Takana of Hillel was the fiction that you can say that you're passing them on when you don't. Which is not bad except for one thing. The Nusach doesn't say anything about passing on documents. It just says, I want the right to collect at any time all loans that are pending. One second. I want to point out to you that this is not Rebbe's opinion that the borrower has to, according to Tavyad Rina, that the lender has, but there are other sources here that imply the lender has to be there because the borrower has to be there because the borrower isn't there. Obviously, because he says all loans that are pending that I have for everybody, all my borrowers. So the borrower isn't here. So this certainly isn't Rebbe's opinion. It is certainly the opinion of Chachamim, or at least that development. Yes, I see the three questions. Yes.
The idea that the Beit Din can actually preempt, and I don't understand the idea that the Beit Din can actually say, so forget about Shemitah, thank you very much. We agree you collect after Shemitah.
I have to ask you to be a favor. Forget about Shemitah for a while. Otherwise, we're not going to get anywhere. You have to understand, my whole point is that it wasn't enacted in the context of Shemitah, it just affects Shemitah. That's what makes it work, because we have a general takana that allows, that gives, of a court, when that loans turn into court orders. So that's all. And then once it becomes a court order, it no longer relates to Shemitah.
I'm tomorrow allowed to go to my neighbor's house and take his money.
Yeah.
would that be then be a master bestid, even if it had no justification?
Yes. Hefker Beitin Hefker. I hope that we're judging present day Beitin, but thinking about it, no, that's the case. But I hope they will be honest and not do that for kind of protection or something. But assuming that the Beitin have the Hefker Beitin Hefker, the particular terminology is later terminology. But the Beitin have a right. They don't use that right in, what do you say, in a flippant way. But they have the right to give you, but not only are what they need, but the courts in that era have the right to do that. Yes?
I can read it differently. I come with a bunch of loans that I've given to other people. I bring all my star and everything with me. I come to the court, and I turn it over to the court. I give them that stuff. The judges are there. And then I say to the judges, you sign here that you judges agree to give me back the money for this whenever I demand.
But that's not what it says.
Well, if you read it, you can read it that way.
No, you can't, not in the Hebrew.
You don't have to have, you don't have to have the borrowers there, you don't have to have the lenders there. You have turned over your debt to the court, so now they are the ones who can collect it. And all you're guaranteeing yourself that the court will pay you.
Yes, what you did now is what I never do, methodology, which is filling in a literary gap of a lot of other information. But first of all, it doesn't say anything about the person bringing his star up to baking. Second of all, it says, Moser Ali Lachem, Ish Poni Gutoni Adayin Shemakom Ploni, which of course are filled in, those are blanks to be filled in, the Ploni. Shikochov Shieshli, any outstanding debts that I have, Shegvenu b'kol makom b'kol zman sheyetze. Shegvenu kol zman sheyetze. I can take them at any time.
What
does the
Hebrew say for
ploni?
What does the Hebrew say about ploni? What does it say?
It says, I hereby declare in front of you, Moser ani.
Yeah.
Moser ani, the words, not Shavuot.
Moser implies transfer. That's what the word Moser means.
Yeah,
transfer. Not
Moser. But nothing is transferred.
But no, maybe they can infer something is transferred.
That's why it says Moser.
I mean, that's why it's using the word Moser. You can say Omer, I mean.
Yeah, but Moser in this context doesn't mean to transfer. Okay, I can't deal with that. I think I could very quickly show you Moser used very often in the context of words and not actually. Yeah. But I don't, but that's less in later usage, so so we have to check. To be exact, we have to check if in ancient Tanaic Hebrew it already exists Moser. So I will accept that as a challenge to show that Moser applies to words as well. But that was done, actually, there was an article written by Professor Hedgeke. He assumed that it was in the Shemitah context. And he dealt with that problem of the Moser, okay? But I'm in his way, because I think it doesn't have to be Shemitah at all. So wait, I want to show you some other things that bear me out, okay? So once that's the case, this is a general statement, we have a problem with an early Prusbo and a late Prusbo. Look at the context of the early and late Prusbo, okay? This is Mishnah Hay. It appears on two Hay, or you can see, three in the English, law five. Like, except that it's mistranslated in the English. So we'll read it in the Hebrew. Pruzbo amukdam kasher amukhar pasul. Shitrei chol amukdavim va psulim va amukharim kasherim. We haven't gotten to half of the proofs yet. We will get to them. I don't know how much time we have. We'll see. Okay. So pruzbo amukdam kasher amukhar pasul. And then the next one is shitrei chol amukdavim psulim va amukharim kasherim. So what is the context of shitrei chol? What's mukdam and mukhar? Misstated, right? If you start chov, how do we describe what start chov was in English?
IOU.
An IOU? If IOU is dated too early, it is then pasul. Okay? Because it changes the rights of the various lenders. Okay? So we would assume that the pruzbul is similar. Okay? Classically, how does pruzbul mukdam and mukhar described? What would you suggest if you were going in the classical vein that it has to do with Shemitah? What's Prusbul HaMukdam and what's HaMukhar?
Written before Shemitah
Day. Written before and after the Shemitah Day. But this is completely different usage than the usage in the Shtar, in the IOU. Completely different usage, which has to do with earlier dating, putting the wrong date on, and not when you actually do the act. So let me say something about our documents, which I say with all Hellenistic documents, which are that the documents state that the witnesses can testify that a certain act was made. For instance, since most people here are married, if you look at your ketubah, what does it say in your ketubah? Anan sahadi, ech amar ploni ben almoni, le ploni bat almoni. Havi le intu kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, va'ana v'siyat nishma'u v'meh v'chulei v'chulei v'chulei, v'kol v'yir v'shel v'kayam. And then the Eidim sign. The Chatan signs only out of custom. There are many kilot. Chatan doesn't sign at all.
Correct.
Yeah, the Litvisha usually the sign. Some kilot.
Naim they sign. Naim they
sign. Yes, which is the ancient custom. The Chatan would add it on because in modern the modern world, usually a person signs his own obligation. So by Minhag, the Minhag developed to have the Chatan sign. And some people still stick to the old-fashioned way without having the Chatan sign, which is fine. So, I didn't know if I was done in Toronto. Chutzlars in general is only the 18? Really? And Eretz Yisrael always had the Chatan. V'gam ani bala chatun. Had the Chatan off the time. Okay, usually. So, when the 18 sign it, they're talking about when it happens, right? So, let's think what would happen if the Eidim or the Dayanim signed the wrong date on the crucible. Okay? I come to Beit and I say, all outstanding loans that I have, Kol Chov Sheyeshli, right, I want the right to collect. So they go over to his chovot, they check his documents, and they give him this writ that gives him the right to do that. Okay? So let's say they put on a later date. What would happen? Or let's say they put on an earlier date. Who is damaged? If they put on a date a year earlier. He said all loans pending. Over that year, he's given out three more loans. So they would not be included. So who's lost?
He's lost.
Nishka Perla. Don't know what. But what happens if you put a date, a future date on? So the Beit Din has given him rights on loans that don't even exist yet. Okay? So that is pasul. So then it follows the same line of reasoning as the shtar, but it happens to be reversed because it gives him rights on everything that happened up till now. But if you put a future date in, then you give him the rights that Beit Din hasn't gone over those materials yet, and Beit Din shouldn't give him the right automatically for things that haven't happened yet. Yes?
Forgive me, a tiny tangential. From the biblical verses, it seems like there's an obligation to give a loan. And it's sinful to do otherwise.
Yeah.
So the first ball you said came into being for reasons other than these sinful thoughts.
No, for sinful thoughts, but not related to Shemitah. Sinful thoughts that had to do with the fact that the lenders were just wary of getting out loans because they were afraid they wouldn't get their money back.
But
that's also a sinful thought.
But the not getting the loan back is a Shemitah. That's when the remission occurs.
No,
they were concerned about ever getting the loan. Like the banks today left money in mortgages. They're all losing their money. What's going on today?
So those are the market. So here we have possible social and economic circumstances. Something like that happened. I don't know what
you're saying.
What?
Circumstantial.
Not related to a halakha shvi'it.
Oh. Okay.
But shvi'it is affected because once Beit Din gives you the right, it also affects shvi'it. Okay? So now I wish I had some more proof. I'll give you a few more proofs because I know it's weird out there, but it's also correct. Yeah.
So you're saying that people would just take their information, their stars or whatever, and go to the Beit Din, and really it's in a sense getting it formalized. That then they can collect. This was just done, as you're saying, and then later was applied to Shemitah.
Yeah, I don't know. If we talk about timing, it may have been the first Shemitah that appeared after that. You know, it's so close. That's why I didn't like when my students said it's a korban, because it's sort of an obvious byproduct.
Okay, but it wasn't done for that purpose alone. That's why it's not a fiction. The repowering and the process exist in other nations at the same time for different reasons altogether. So we can assume that it was enacted for those different reasons. The pasuk that Hillel uses applies. It is appropriate in Shemitah. It explains the context why Puzbo appears at the end of a list of things that Shemitah doesn't apply to. Everybody see how elegant get that is? He has this, but then we read them off. He has this list, and all of a sudden it says, Puzbo ino mishamed. That's really strange. It was enacted just for Shemitah. But it was enacted for other reasons, but it obviously affects Shemitah as well. Then it makes sense. Okay? That was so I want to show you some other proofs for this, and then we can have a long discussion about methodology, which is just look at a few more slight things that imply that this is the case.
Do you have evidence that it was used in Israel?
We don't have any documentation of Puzbo at all.
Wow.
And if there's one flimsy piece in this thesis, it's that we only have one papyrus document at all. However, I hope you notice that it fits all of the Tanakh material perfectly, including two more that I'd like to show you.
Can I just ask about the papyrus document? Is that a Hebrew document?
No. Hellenistic document from Egypt.
So it predates.
Puzbo is not a Jewish word. Puzbo is a Hellenistic
word.
Which means, it means there are different ways of translating it, but usually it means a statement in front of the Dayanim, which also has to do with Moser.
What language? And
Greek.
That's right. They're using football.
Pro ball. Okay. Yeah. You know, every year I come to America, and they have this like. Is this here also something? Sunday or next Sunday?
Next Sunday.
Usually we have a day where I don't have anything to do because everybody's watching a football game. Somebody wants to learn from the football game.
In Detroit, so it's an embarrassment. They were 0-16 this year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, football wasn't their thing ever. It was always hockey. Detroit. Detroit's like their eyes going there, son. Yeah, Gordie Howe. And his two sons. Okay.
He was a Canadian.
What?
He was a Canadian.
He was?
He's a Florida Saskatchewan.
Wow.
Didn't
know. So even the Detroit's claim to fame is really Canadian. So Detroit and Canada really won. We used to have an Akiva activities in Windsor every Sunday. You know, it's like nothing. You're over the bridge. Yeah, okay.
Suppose we agree with your thesis. What's the consequence of what you're saying?
Well, so let me tell you the story. I gave this shiur at my nephew's ufu, and she has a Haredi uncle who works in business, and he said, my Chiloni friends are knocking me all the time for years about these fictions in Halakha, and one they bring up is Puzbo. And he said, oh, now I can breathe again, because Puzbo is not a fiction at all. And it wasn't created to circumvent Shemitah. It circumvents Shemitah for a very natural reason, which is that it is no longer alone. It is now a Maaseh Beitin. And it just happens to circumvent Shemitah. Or I would say a very positive byproduct. Well, wasn't instituted just for that. It's not selling your chametz to a goy on Pesach. It's not some kind of fiction. It's something that the courts did for the business world to make sure that loans would be out there for the people, right? At the business world of their time. And it has to do with another thing, which is I noticed in many sugiyot, that the original Batei Dinim, since they have responsibility for society as a whole, were not only involved in ritual issues. Very often when you get to the Bavli interprets things as having something to do with some kind of ritual issue, but it didn't necessarily have to do with a ritual issue. Okay, sometimes the Rishonim, right? So there are many sugiyot, but you see the earlier source material, you see that it's not necessarily ritual, it's not necessarily mitzvah, it's not necessarily yisur. Sometimes it's very nice what the Bavli does. If you look at the first Mishnah in Bava Batra, you will see that it has to do with
setting up a system for, I guess you would call it zoning, and preventing certain legal problems in the future, because then you have an assumption that people build the fences in their yards in the middle on both of their lands using materials from both property owners. So if it's three generations later after the land has been sold, the wall falls down. The walls fall down all the time in the near Middle East in this era. Then you will have no problem deciding where to put the wall up again, which part of the yard belongs to who, and whose materials should be used. But the Gemara says we have a deeper problem, which is the right of privacy. Going so far as the Ramban said, if your neighbor's window is open, you should close your own blind, so not to look in. That's how far he goes. The Ramban is very extreme. Most of the Rishonim are more mild. So there the Gemara takes something which is just a civil ordinance and gives it wonderful value. Okay? But very often the early Tanakh material has civil meaning. So it means that the courts were concerned with other issues, not only these issues. They can't get there. Right? It doesn't only have to do with the kippah and the tawah, it has to do with the Chachamim were concerned with the welfare of society. It has Torah basis, this concern. Because the Torah is against people not giving loans. So there is, in that sense, it has a mitzvah connotation, but it's a very general connotation. Can I just want, yes?
Just for information purposes, did a loan always involve a shtar?
No, but if it didn't have a shtar, you didn't have leaning on property. Okay, so one of the things that happens that's very interesting is because of that, the Prusbul, we're not going to get into that, it's a very delicate issue, the Prusbul was enacted only on land as well. In order to have a Prusbul, the borrower had to have land, or at least the Arev. How many Arev? The guarantor had to have land, and that's a whole story in itself.
I thought that it said here that the Prusbul only was applicable when there wasn't security taken. If there was security taken, like you said, for a pledge, then you didn't have to worry about it. I thought it was an unsecured loan that this is all this was talking about.
No, the unsecured... you have to differentiate between shiabud and mashkon. Jay, you're going to have to help me with this. So the shiabud and mashkon, all written shtarot have shiabud. They have they have a leaning on the land. But mashkon is something much more specific, where you actually have something. Like usually it's metaphor, even something you have in your hand.
I understand movable, but you would think that the poor people who really needed loans wouldn't own land.
So that's why we have this whole process. There's a fiction that comes in here, and eventually they say that even if we have a beehive, it's enough to have a crucible. That's what happens. We're not talking about that development, but there's a development here to make that part of it sort of fictitious. In other words, you can have a crucible with very minimal land, even a beehive. Okay? So actually, that's one of the things I want to discuss now.
But wouldn't that also mean that if you have a shtar, even if it's for
some... But very poor people in this area were usually farmers who lost their crop that year because of a drought or something along those lines. Very often they were poor farmers, not necessarily artisans. So it's not necessarily true that they can have
anything. It's just based maybe on this one. So if a lender had a shtar, or whatever then, and he couldn't retrieve what was owed to him by any means, could he not go to the court post factum and say, look, I've got a shtar here at sea, and I want to claim whatever it is that I need? Why would you need the prosecutor?
Okay, so the idea of the Prusbul is to facilitate that in a much quicker fashion without litigation. It has a lot to do with things like prenuptials today. Why do people write prenuptials? So that at the end, even though obviously the woman has the right to her ketubah, right? And very often she has the right to be divorced, not always. But it's always litigation, very difficult litigation. It takes years and years. Unfortunately, also because of the court system, but in Israel, it takes years and years. So, if you have a prenuptial, you facilitate it much. It's much easier to facilitate that.
So, the impediment to lenders, as far as lenders were concerned, in terms of their lending to borrowers, Was this litigation process?
Right. Yeah, I think so. That's a guesstimate. I assume that that's what the problem is, because we have similar concepts that try to circumvent that. Yes?
Presumably, since every person has one asset as themselves, as long as you have an evident lease,
yeah.
You can always have an asset tracking any stuff, so there's no problem.
Yeah, except that Evidy V wasn't used at all during this period. We don't have any evidence of Evidy V during this period. Okay? So that's.
So Evidy V was.
And also, that's always a last resort.
No, but since you need the fiction of an asset.
Yeah. So the way they. It's always hard to guess when we get to this kind of question. The asset they used was the lowest asset was Kaver Dvorim, a beehive. They didn't go beyond that. I guess a beehive was like something. Yeah, you know, it's very minimal. Anyway, at least I say one thing right in the shiur.
That's right for sure.
No arguments about that. Okay. So I want to show you, I think the best thing to do now, before we have a discussion about methodology, is to show you two more mishnayot, and that's all. I won't show you the one about the, you can do number 4 on your own, okay? But we'll do number 5 and number 6. Okay? This is a very interesting development. Okay, this has to do with your last question here in this corner. The last question. It directly deals with everything you ask is perfectly right out of the ball. And it's exactly you, and which sort of shows the thesis is right, because you ask all the questions that the sources deal with. So here's one that's really interesting. Let's see I get the any tuba. Go back to bata. Tubav at number 5, right? Tubav any maget. He omered about giti, he omered about shumchi. There used to be a receipt for giving a get. Okay? V'chein bal chov, shotzi shtar chov, v'eni mo prosbul, which shows us that eventually the prosbul became a standardized process. Okay? Later on we have something called, parallel to that, kiyum shtar. But at one point, the natural process always on all shtar chov, always to get this writ from Beitin, which is proposable. Notice that if you talk about Shemitah context, this is all very weird. Because why are you talking about this as being an aberrant thing, having a shtar without a proposable? What if it's the first year of the Shemitah year and the due date is 1 year following, or even a month? Stam ha'avod shoshim yom. Da'arei enu lo yifru. So the original Mishnah said at some point in time, proposable became so standardized that if you had a tuba without a get, or if you had a prusbol without a shtar without a prusbol, you could not collect the money at all because it looks fishy. Every average lender goes and takes out a prusbol. If you don't have a prusbol, something's weird here, and we are wary that something isn't absolutely correct. Just like a woman who has her tuba but has no get and wants to collect her tuba. And then the Mishnah says, Rabban Shimon ben Liel Omer, Mina Sakana Ve'elech, which has to do with Roman impression, Isha Govak Tubata Shelo Beget, Ubal Chov Goveh Shelo Bepuzbo. Okay, because you can no longer, it was very difficult to hold on to your documents during that time. So there was reason to assume it was no longer fishy to have one argument document without its partner. Right? It always partnered. The tuba and the get. The shtar chov and the prusbol. But in dire circumstances, people have all this oppression, it didn't necessarily imply that something fishy was going on if you only had one and not the other. Okay? So from here we see two things. First of all, it is very difficult to explain this Mishnah in the context of Shvi'it. Because why would it say, so you know what you do, this is what was done previously. You fill in literary gaps, you'd say. Shtachol, ve'eni mo prusbol, you cannot collect with a shtachol without a prusbol, when? After Shemitah. But then what is it doing here with the get and the tubah? Very weird, but if you assume that it has general application, it fits perfectly. Okay, so that's the first one. The second one that I'd like to share, so that's like a clincher, right? So I hope now I've convinced everybody. And now number 6. Hayvim chotmim al haget b'nei tikkun olam. This is where I started from. The whole shiur started from Gittin. not the Gittin Suya of Lamed Bab, just for knowing this Mishnah. Hayim Chotvim al Get Mitnei Tikkun Olam, Hillel Hikim Pruzbo Mitnei Tikkun Olam. So if you look at the context of this Mishnah and the context of Tikkun Olam in general, it always has to do with general social and economic issues and not with something specific, some kind of specific halachic problem. So just like we have the Edim, notice how similar the context is. Why would we want Edim on the get? On a woman's get. So that her get would be verified and she can go on to the next community and get married again. Right? That's why it's also very important for her to know that she received the get. The sugya talk about, there's many sugya that talk about a husband who, I guess he has a bit of an emotional problem giving the get. So he wants to give her the get without her knowing about it. And so these husbands are always shut down. They're shut down because what use is the woman, for the woman to have a get when she doesn't know about it and she can't remarry? Okay, so she's a kind of ancient aguna. So the conclusion of the sugya is always that she must know about it. It's questions of timing, when she has to know about it, but she has to know about it. So she needs the get to continue her life, so it should be verified by AD. So we would assume that the Prusbol is for a similar purpose, Netikun Olam, and not something that's very specific. It should be, this is less of an argument. This is what
actually, I think this weakens it a little bit.
Okay.
Because we saw where it earlier said Hillel did for the purpose of Shemitah.
Never.
In the earlier Mishnah here.
No. Never. There's only one place it sort of implies it, which is a Sifrei. Or maybe. Yes, so I want to posit, if that wasn't clear, that the only reason it appears to be Shemitah is because the only pasuk in the Torah that talks about people not giving loans is in the Shemitah context. So he used that pasuk. But, in reality, Hillel was not concerned with that at all. That's all. There's only one pasuk that talks about that people not giving loans. I don't think it has to do with Shemitah at all. It does have to do with Shemitah, in one sense, and that it's sort of an obvious application, but it's not the major application. Okay, so that's all. I think there's what we call it a mirage. There's like a mirage here. The mirage is created because it appears in the Mishnah in Shvi, and because there are two things that create the mirage. Okay, one is that it appears in the context of Masechet Shvi. Okay, and the other is that Hillel uses a pasuk related to Shvi. That's what creates the mirage. But I think it's a mirage. I think that it was enacted for other reasons. And Dafka, the Mishnah Shvi, implies that because it puts it at the end of the list of things that don't have Shvi done, then so what? Okay, so that, there is another way of handling that, by the way. I thought a lot about that when I wrote the article. Originally, I wrote two suggestions, and then my topic said it would confuse the readers. So the two suggestions were, one is that this is a mirage, which I suggested, and the other one is that this Mishnah was written after Prusbol only was relevant to Shvi'it. So I want to show you a source, because in the end result, that's where we're at. I want to show you that there's a source that implies that it's only for Shvi'it. I think that's where, okay? But I want to make the positive suggestion. Since there was a time when the Prusbol was no longer relevant to regular Havot. What time was that? Roman persecution. So it was only left as a fiction for Shvi'it. That positive effect became the only effect available. Okay? So let me show you that source. So you know that the Babli didn't fall on his head, get up on the wrong side of the bed or something. The Babli is based on a Tosefta. Okay? Number 11. Okay? So I indented it because it seems to be a later addition to the Tosefta, but it appears. Okay? Imatai kotvim puzbu erev Rosh Hashanah shel Shvi'it. Katbo erev, does everybody see that? The bold letters. Katbo erev Rosh Hashanah shel Motzei Shvi'it Ava pisha chozer v'koro l'achar mikein gover la v'olech apilu l'zman merube. So here there's one Tanaik, I don't know, Tosefta is a Baraita which was compiled from the earliest time of the Tanaik. Of course, my opinion, there's a big argument in the academic world. Shama Friedman wrote a whole book which is called
Tosafata Atikata, in which he tries to prove that there are parts of Tosefta which are very ancient, which was considered very revolutionary, even though it seems very simple to me, because the greats of Talmudic scholarship, Professor Epstein, Professor Albeck, Professor Lieberman, they all thought that Tosefta was, as its name is, in addition to the Mishnah. So they thought it was late. And Shammai came to talk to me like, I think 15 years ago, and he said, you know, there are parts of the Tosefta which are very ancient. And I said, wow, that's obvious. I said, what's the big chidush? And he said, the big chidush is that everybody thinks otherwise. And the reason I thought it was obvious was because I always asked my students what was earlier, the Tosefta or the Mishnah. Very often they said, the Mishnah seems to be a synopsis of the Tosefta. And sometimes the Tosefta seems older than the Mishnah. But these particular words, Eimatai, Bamed Varim Amurim, are very often a later edition. In any case, it's early. The latest of the Tosefta compiled was like second generation Amoraim. So very early on, the Prusbo became relevant only for Shvi'it. See, considering that Shimon ben Gamliel already says that the Prusbo is no longer necessary for regular loans, is everybody following me? This is very early. It means that by the time the Bavli reached Prusbo, certainly its only effect was for Shvi'it. Okay? So that's why unfortunately the gentleman is not here anymore, but when I said I do want to disagree with the Bavli, I don't really want to disagree with the Bavli, I just want to say that the Bavli is very complicated. If you look at Yigitin Lamed Bavli, you see the Bavli is complicated, it has this complication with Prusbo. I'll explain it in a few minutes, why the Bavli gets so complicated with it. Because the Bavli sees the Prusbo as this fiction. It appears as a fiction because its general usage got lost, is no longer relevant, and remained only in Shvi'it. And then the Bavli says, how could Hillel possibly have done this fiction against a pasuk in the Torah? How could he have circumvented a pasuk in the Torah? And then the Bavli says, he did not, one second, I'll finish up. And then the Bavli says, well, it wasn't really against the Torah because in Hillel's time, Shvi'it was no longer from the Torah. So they had to write that. So then they ask, wait a minute, so what was the problem at all? So they have to go,
Benatipot,
exactly. That's how you say it in English. Benatipot. So they say that even though Shvi'it was no longer Doraita, Shvi'it was enacted through Hefker Beit Din Hefker, and then circumvented through Prusbo. Do we follow that? So there we follow that. So that's what we call, the Rishonim call Shnuyat Chuka. In other words, the Gemara is having so much difficulty working out this fiction that it does this very complicated process. So now we have a simple explanation. So I'll go through the steps once again. Prusbo is enacted in the Hellenistic world to help people receive their debt. And then the lenders went to Beit Din and got this court order that allowed them to receive their debt. At one time it was done with the appearance of the borrowers at court. Eventually it became something which was standardized and was done on a general basis and had a general wording, which was all loans that are pending. At one point this was so much a part of the process that if you had a regular document, IOU, without a Prusbo, it was considered something fishy, and you could not then collect your loan. Okay? Then, because of Roman impression, the Prusbo could no longer be demanded, and it came out of vogue. Since it is considered a matzeh Beit Din, similar to Gzar Beit Din, but not exactly the same, it then means that the Shvita is no longer relevant in that context because it's considered a court order, and as it came out of vogue, the only effect that remained was that its usage for Shvi'it. So it appears in our eyes in an elusive way, it's something which is a fiction to get rid of Shmitah Kesafim. That's why it appears to be a fiction, but it wasn't really a fiction originally.
Why didn't they know that in the Bible? Why didn't the parents get to know all this?
Okay, mythological questions. Wait, but there was a question before you, Jay, so...
Okay, sorry.
So I'll get back to you. Yes?
Isn't it a distinction without a difference? So, if they used an already existing technique to circumvent the Torah law, so what?
No, I say the technique was used to circumvent a different problem, which was recalcitrant borrowers.
Right.
And then it automatically affected Shmeet because once the court order, the Shmeet doesn't apply to it like any other court order.
But it still is being used.
So in the end result is that court order is only used in the context of Shmeet. Okay. Still, it wasn't enacted for that purpose. So the difference between purposely trying to circumvent something in the Torah and something that just happens. There's a whole list of things that circumvent.
The point is that the so-called fiction, by the way, the word fiction is wrong and it shouldn't be used in this context. I don't know what word is right, legalism or some other term, but it's not a fiction.
It's used as a legal fiction. Usually that's the word used.
It's an incorrect use of the word fiction.
Harama.
It is in English an incorrect use of the word
fiction. Okay.
It's not a fiction. If you know what fiction is, it's not a fiction. But the point is that you call it whatever you want, legalism, yeah, fiction, whatever, it's using a technique to circumvent the Torah law.
No, but it wasn't used for that purpose. There's a whole list of things that circumvent Shemitah, and it is one of the things that circumvent Shemitah. But the other ones could have also been used. This one was used because it became a general process. This is every loan was done with approval at one time. So therefore, if she fell on an ordinary loan, there was already approval at hand. So the Shmeet was already circumvented just by procedure.
Essentially, if you didn't have a protocol already, you'd have to invent one.
Right. You would have to invent one, but it didn't say no, it has to do... It is academic in the sense that the final result is the final result. In that sense, but 32 hours, an academic thing. What do you want? We want to understand processes. I want to understand processes. I want to understand concepts. The importance of this is not that. The importance is that Chachamim were concerned with general social and economic problems. The end of my article, I say the importance of this is to know that one time, Beit Din wasn't only concerned with the color of your straps of tefillin. There were other concerns. They were concerned with the welfare of human beings. And even though this is for the betterment of the lenders, the way the Mishnah describes it was that if we don't do better with the lenders, we're going to have a problem for the borrowers. Because every Chachamim understood that this is a seesaw situation. Just like when you raise minimum wages, you create unemployment. Sometimes you have to help. I don't know what you've done with your auto industry in New York. But sometimes you have to help the elite in order to help the common person. If the elite don't think they can get their loans back, they're not going to give loans. Zedvar Pli'al. There's social criticism in Hillel's words of that process. But in spite of that social criticism, we have to find a way of dealing with the situation. Very often the poskim, you should know, very often in shooting, later shooting as well, the poskim have leniencies because they can't solve the basic social illness. The Rama married a couple on Shabbat against the Mishnah of Poreshet, because of social ills that he described as Maaseh Satan, but he can't control the social ills. All he can do is help the poor girl out by letting her get married on Shabbat. And so that's the way. Poskim don't have control. They think they have control of everything, but they don't have control over everything. And even in the time of Hillel, they didn't always have control. All they could was just move their magic wand and make the lenders give out loans when they weren't sure they were going to get their money back. So they tried to affect the situation. That's what's important in this. And there are many sugyot like that. Yes. Okay. Well, that's your elder first. Not like in the Sanhedrin, where it was reversed. The other people came first.
Maybe I need a little bit of historical background. So when did Hillel live in terms? So you're basically saying that at the time when Hillel lived, there was no such thing as proof.
No.
And he introduced the concept of Prozbul,
or did he introduce the concept of principle which existed already, but he made it applicable to Schmidt?
No, neither A nor B. Oh, I claim. And I think, although this is, I'm going on a little bit because we don't know the exact details of this thought process. I think, I'll tell you why I think this also. I think the principle exists in the neighboring countries, and Hillel adopted it for the Jewish court system. Not for Shemitah purposes. Shemitah immediately became one of the Nafkaminot of it, but it wasn't the only Nafkamina. Okay? You understand my Aramaic? It became a very important byproduct immediately, but it wasn't the original, only the original.
From that time until Babli, when suddenly they no longer use the plural.
Okay, the reason is that we have a Mishnah. We have a Mishnah that says that Puzbol was no longer available because of oppression. It can no longer be demanded. So then loans were no longer made with the Puzbol. Instead, they used something else, which is called Kiyum. They had this process of notarization, which gave the Shtar a little more clout, but it never could reach that clout of the Puzbol. It's Mishnah Mefreshet in Ketubot. Ketubot says that at one time you could no longer demand the Puzbol. So the only Puzbol was only left as a remnant of this original very wide takanah. It was left only in the context of Shmita. That only the byproduct could be used because it could no longer use it. It's Mishnah Mefureshet, it could no longer be used. Yes?
Wait,
there's another way of going, which is to say that Hillel invented the Puzbol for everybody in the Hellenistic world. But those are people I don't know how to say that. I thought they're really crazy, poor people that think that we invented everything for the whole world. Right? I would assume that the opposite is true, that it was invented in the world and we utilized it. Yes?
Is it then maybe more important, would it be correct to say, from the reading of your page against some sources, would it be saying that it's more important, it looks like it's a mitzvah or whatever, to forgive loans in the seventh year, and then, but it's also a mitzvah to, you know, prefer to make those loans. And I think what they're saying is, you know, people, you know, realistically, aren't going to make those loans if they have to forgive them.
That's the final outcome, but my idea is that wasn't the original purpose. The final outcome is that there is the value system says it's more important to have. There's no.
That's what I'm asking. It's more important that the people.
That there be loans. There's no point in foregoing loans that don't exist. It's just like the argument about Shvi'i today, where the Nassif said back when, the Nassif said there's no point in settling the land of Israel, we can't keep Shemitah. And other people said, there's no chance of us ever keeping Shemitah if we can't settle the land of Israel. The only way to settle the land of Israel is to do Heter Mechira. So that's like a Puzbol argument. But that is classical Puzbol argument. There's no point in having Shemitah Kshafim if you have no loss. But in my thesis, Puzbol existed originally for another purpose. Yes?
The only issue, though, raises a theological question. What is the point? Several rules, not just the one of Shemitah, but one of the Levites and so forth, where essentially the system immediately has to circumvent it. But that's a theological question, rather.
Okay, I'm willing to deal with that also. Okay? I will deal with that, and I have a book of drashot that will be published soon. It's being published this week in Hebrew, and will be published soon in English. And one of my drashot, not exactly drashot, we call them he bonenut hagutit beparshat haShavua. This is not exactly the usual drasha. So one of them I talk about this very strange thing that appears at the end of Sefer Vayikra. And on one hand, we have a very clear, especially in Vayikra, a very clear attempt of the Torah to get rid of the whole concept of Eved Ivri. And on the other hand, immediately after we have Dinei Arachin, where a person can commit himself to a donation to the Mikdash based on his value as what?
A slave.
So via that vista, I tried to deal with your question. And what I suggest is this, that the Torah in its laws
includes both a picture of an ideal world and implementing the laws in a real situation. Okay, so we have these two things always plagued. There's tension between these two things, this ideal world and the real world. So in the real world, at the time the Torah was given, people were valued in dollars and cents. So if you donated yourself to the Mikdash, the only way to deal with that is to understand how much you'd be worth in the slave market, because there was a slave market. However, the Torah also paints a picture of an ideal world in which slaves do not exist at all. So we have this problem throughout history of how these things interplay. Okay, so that's where we get to these. Sometimes I think that in any specific society, these utopian pictures can never really play themselves out, but they do affect us in terms of our mores. Let's talk about Shemitah. This is what we said, Shemitah here, not only Shemitah Kisafim. Okay, so there's this very strange circumstances in which now in Israel, many people are against the term Mechira. And they do these various other solutions, like Otsar Beitim. And these other solutions are against the spirit of Shemitah, because the spirit of Shemitah is Vachlu Evyonei Amecha. And these other solutions make the fruits more expensive. So sometimes you wonder whether the interplay between the ideal and the reality is done in the right way. Right? So here too we could discuss whether or not there should be a way, some people are thinking about this, whether there should be a way to set up an economic system which is less dependent on heteriska, for example. But those, before we implement those, we have to be very careful, because very often the way these ideas are implemented directly into the real situation creates damage. Just like the Shemitah ideal, the way people are trying to implement it now in Israel, immediate way, creates damage and actually is the reverse of the original ideal. So that's why I think your question is one of the most important questions. One of the most important questions is the interaction between the ideal world that the Torah professes and the realities of the situation. Sometimes the Torah itself, here's another good example, this also appears in my Midrash. Shimon and Levi, the Torah is horribly critical of what they say, except for one line that the Torah actually accepts. And the reason that dinah is like a zonah is because of an ancient rule which says that the rapist can pay off the family, which changes her into a zonah. Is that clear? Because there's payment. It's not the fact that she was just raped, it's that she can be paid off. Okay? But that is a halakha which appears in the Torah itself. Right? Onus u'mufater. In Parashat Mishpatim and in Parashat Ki Tetzeh. So I think that the story, the biblical story, tries to show us an ideal beyond the necessities of the time. In other words, at the time, the only way to deal with the rapist and the mepater, seducer, was to give compensation to the family. But the Torah realizes that compensation has horrible implications for society. So it expresses that the problem with this law that acquiesces to the present day situation through the biblical story of Dinah and the only words that the Torah accepts of Shimon and Levi. Because everything else they do is horrible, but the Torah does agree with their words. So I think there's a very critical problem playing these things out, and I think that good poskim play out the ideals and the reality as best as they can.
Okay, thank you very much. you. Our hosts weren't here before, so I wanted, when we did the introduction, they each walked in a couple minutes late. You know, Stuart Lesser and David Moreski, who are sponsoring both, they lost their fathers a year ago, just within a week of each other.
So we should have said just, Louis Nishmatan.
That's what we did. We put it on the thing. I just want to publicly acknowledge it now that they're here, and that's what we had on the flyer. So we should have Hasimtas and for many years, all of us in good health, and thank you very much.
By the way, I didn't say, I was very happy the way you participated, because I always say to my Talmidim that the job of our Shiva is retrocesis, and the job of the Talmidim is to to prove him wrong, which you almost were successful in.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.